the immediate release of a number of jailed women's rights activists arrested in 2018.
What we said on the eve of the G20 is that Saudi Arabia's real change makers, the activists who spearheaded campaigns for women's rights, are in jail or facing trial. Riyadh is an inappropriate host.
Since assuming the G20 presidency in December last year, Riyadh has publicized new initiatives on women's employment opportunities, claiming that the kingdom is strongly committed to empowering women and girls.
On the occasion of the G20 summit, the Embassy of Saudi Arabia in Italy has organized a webinar on females' inclusion in society. Human rights groups have slammed these initiatives as mere attempts to reshape the kingdom's image through expensive PR campaigns, presenting Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman as a reformer.
The Crown has spent billions of dollars hosting major political, entertainment, cultural and sporting events as a deliberate strategy to deflect from the country's image as a pervasive human rights violator, to whitewash its dismal rights record.
Saudi Arabia is using the G20 meeting in Riyadh to build legitimacy. Bear in mind that bin Salman is behind the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi and the Yemen war. The kingdom is cashing in on Donald Trump's staunch support all along the way.
Saudi Arabia is the first Arab nation to host the G20 summit. The meeting of the leaders of the world's most industrialized countries and emerging economies will be held on November 21st and 22nd. Max Civili, Rome.
A high-level conference focusing on the EU's treatment of refugees has just concluded in the European Parliament, Brussels. During the event, the 27-nation bloc's migration and asylum policy was slated. It appears a new crisis is emerging at sea as desperate African refugees try to reach EU territory.
Look what is already happening in the Atlantic. Hundreds of people are trying to reach the Canary Islands. Through the Atlantic, one of the most perilous routes in the world, they are dying there.
The EU unveiled a new asylum policy in September, but critics say the focus is on closing the bloc's borders instead of respecting international law and upholding the EU's much trumpeted values.
Our staff has spoken out against policies which are directly responsible for this unimaginable human suffering. Time and again, European nations and institutions have failed to act on their duty.
Many organizations insist the EU should be viewing immigration as an opportunity rather than a threat.
Behind all those people, there are hidden skills. We need to identify those skills and to use those skills in our European labor market.
The EU is paying billions of euro to Turkey and several African nations to try and prevent refugees from traveling. During the Brussels event, Ankara was accused of using the refugee crisis to advance geopolitical goals.
It is wrong to endorse the popular view of Turkey as a victim of the war in Syria. Turkey is on war in Syria since its very last start.
However, Ankara is highly critical of the European Union over its handling of the problem. Refugees continue to die in the Mediterranean. Those who make it are held in very poor conditions on Greek islands and now Spanish islands too.
Perhaps the most compelling argument being made by rights groups for the EU to do more is because the West has fueled so much conflict in the Middle East and Africa, effectively playing a big role in helping to create the refugee crisis. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
There are claims of discrimination at this school that highlighted the entrenched racism which resides in the broader community here. Among the accounts, children of colour were described with highly derogatory terms by teachers and fellow learners who were excluded from certain activities. And when this was protested, white individuals from the area violently attacked those raising concerns. Protesters say by perpetuating this attitude, which is reminiscent of the apartheid years, youth born under South Africa's democracy are still being taught old racial tendencies.
that we're against the racism. We're not against the white people. You must be correct with that. We're not against with white people. They are humans like us. But the way they treat us, it's like we're not humans.
But today, as before, the police were clearly set to protect the white community, blocking all efforts by the protesters to make progress. Demonstrators point to a broader issue with how the government continues to target the vulnerable.
It was just a peaceful protest because no one did anything to harm the police. We're just peacefully and then raising our voices that enough is enough. So they started to do this thing because we are black.
This is an illusion of democracy that we are getting. It's just a democracy that we have received just only to vote. But in terms of freedom, we're not free.
Scenes of a riot that we have witnessed here in this area today. Stun grenades, rubber bullets, as well as water cannons used to disperse the crowd. And so they were prevented from handing over their memorandum of demands, which of course was against racism within this area.
At this point, there appears little effort by authorities to make a move against racism here. The Provincial Education Department has rejected calls by the South African Human Rights Commission for a probe or any action against teachers accused of racism. The opposition left-leaning economic freedom fighters, which has led these protests, say it is this attitude that will only ensure they continue with their protests. Hassan Siriop, Cape Town.
Both mainstream parties in the United States have been profoundly shaken by the election results from November 3rd. While the Democrats may prevail in the still-disputed presidential election, their so-called blue wave has been universally described as an abject disaster. Despite unprecedented mainstream media support, widespread leftist-based protests, and record fundraising, they failed to retake the Senate, lost seats in the House, lost one governorship, and failed to flip a single state legislature. Because this is a census year, Republicans will control drawing up most of the decade's new electoral maps, causing many to say the election was a disastrous setback for progressive causes.
70% of Republicans, 90% of Democratic voters are for Medicare for All. They're for the ending of student debt. They're for a UBI to sustain them, especially during COVID. So these things are very progressive, and the Democrats were against them.
Massive infighting among the party elite is being reported. Older and moderate Democrats blame newly popular progressive causes for the losses, but the Democratic Socialists of America, the left wing of the Democratic Party, won 70% of the races and ballot initiatives they endorsed.
The Democrats really aren't progressive. I would attribute their losses to putting up bad candidates, candidates that are very centrist. So this is the strategy of the Democrats, is we need to be more centrist or more rightist centrist, and they'll blame progressives.
The election results were widely expected to be a repudiation of so-called Trumpism, but analysts say they actually cemented the unprecedented political uprising unexpectedly led by Donald Trump. So-called Trumpian Republicans are now expected to reshape the Conservative Party. There seems to be unanimous agreement that regardless of the final outcome of the presidential election, Trump and his family will have increased, not decreased, control over the Republican Party. A pre-election poll asked Republicans and Republican-leaning independents if they considered themselves a supporter of Trump or a supporter of the Republican Party. 60% picked Trump.
Whichever presidential candidate is finally inaugurated, it seems certain that America has undergone a dramatic political shift, which few people predicted and which many are struggling to understand and accept. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Sheikh Zazaki's trial continued in a Kaduna State High Court in northern Nigeria with the presentation of two prosecution witnesses. The two witnesses were officers of the Nigerian Army who made their presentations in court while journalists stay outside.
They gave evidence about the operation, of the military operation that lasted between the 12th and the 14th of December 2015, and the role played by each of them. We just want to see how far we can go tomorrow. The case, the prosecution is not likely to close the case tomorrow. So we then take other days so that we can speedily, you know, have this matter concluded.
Sheikh Ibrahim Zazaki is being tried for culpable homicide, unlawful assembly, disruption of public peace, among other allegations, which the Islamic movement has described as fabricated and baseless. In December 2015, soldiers of the Nigerian army attacked Zazaki's home and worship center, killing over 340 of his supporters. No soldier has been charged for the mass murders of Zazaki's supporters, despite the recommendation of a judicial commission of inquiry set up by the Kaduna State Government. Sheikh Zazaki has been in detention for close to 5 years in violation of the ruling of a federal high court ordering for his release.
The Nigerian judiciary is a very independent judiciary. So by the grace of Allah, there is going to be a way out for Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki, in as much as the Nigerian judiciary remain independent. Definitely there is going to be a way out for Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki through the constitutional means.
Despite being a public trial, no journalist or any member of the Zazaki family has ever been allowed inside the courtroom. Meanwhile, Zazaki supporters have continued to demand for his release in accordance with the order of a federal high court in Abuja. Benjamin Abdullahi, Abuja.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech from IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Muhammad Ali Javdan. Please stay tuned.
صبر میکنند این صبر خیلیه دیگه.
There are several verses in the Holy Quran which indicate the importance of patience in case of committing sins. This means that a person endures the difficulties of not committing sins. For instance, a young person who controls his or her lust is in fact showing patience towards the hardships that befall him or her during not committing the sweet sins in the environment.
فرمایش امیرالمومنین تو نهج البلاغه داره که یه کسانی که یه همچین جاهایی صبر میکنن این مثلا فرشته ها.
This point is also mentioned by Imam Ali alayhi salam in the book Nahj al-Balagha. He describes such people who show endurance in not committing sins. Imam Ali alayhi salam also describes the angels who are responsible for recording our deeds during life. In his words, angels of Allah are surprised by the extent of the patience of faithful person towards the sins. The situation is like being fired from inside. Now, this fire does not mean the ordinary fire. This is the hotness of the sin which is fired inside the soul of someone, and patience upon it is like cold water poured on that. According to Imam Ali alayhi salam, such people have high and great souls, and that's why angels are shocked by the power of the control by such people over their souls in order to not commit sin. According to the Holy Quran, the people who control their desires and are patient enough not to commit sins will enter paradise without their other deeds being reckoned. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Muhammad Ali Jafdan. To find out more about this program and our other programs, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en/Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care, and goodbye.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Russia says the United States has deceived Moscow, and the international community after it conducted an advanced intercontinental missile interception test. Russia's foreign ministry says the exercise used technology that is part of the Aegis Ashore missile defense system, which the Pentagon had assured the Kremlin was not aimed at Russia's long-range capabilities. A Russian foreign ministry spokesperson has described the development as quote-unquote a new confirmation of the dangerous and destabilizing character of Washington's anti-ballistic missile strategy and, quote, obvious anti-Russian orientation. Maria Zakharova says the test proved the falsity of American statements, saying, quote, for many years, America assured us that the interception of Russian ICBMs by American standard systems including this modification, is technically impossible. There are fears the test risks paving the way for Russia testing similar technologies against America's intercontinental ballistic missiles. Moscow has already stated that it reserves the right to take the necessary response measure. On Monday, the U.S. military used the new advanced technology to fire, for the first time, a missile from a warship which downed an ICBM. Previously, the U.S. had promoted the weapons system as being limited against short and intermediate-range missile threats. Russia says this is direct evidence and a concrete example of how Washington manipulated public opinion of its country, lied to its international partners, and justified its actions in the international arena with far-fetched pretexts. Following the collapse of the INF and before the anti-ballistic missile treaty, the only remaining U.S.-Russian nuclear arms control agreement, New START, is also, as things stand, set to expire early next year. Moscow says it hasn't closed the door on negotiations to extend the agreement, formerly known as the New Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty. The projected U.S. presidential election winner, Joe Biden, has previously said he will explore the treaty's extension without conditions. However, bilateral relations between the two countries have always been on very shaky grounds. Analysts say the latest American missile test will only escalate military tensions. Amid Russia's worsening relations with NATO, it could not have come at a worse time. Questions have been raised as to whether the U.S. may use the system against Russian military interests. The weapon used to down the ICBM, the Standard Missile 3 or SM-3, is part of the Aegis Ballistic Missile Defense System. Moscow has long suspected the system to be a major pathway to a U.S. global missile shield to undermine Russia's military power. The SM-3 missiles have also been deployed close to Russian soil, in Poland and Romania. Moscow says it has repeatedly warned it would take similar measures to ensure national security and maintain a strategic stability. Essentially, that means more sophisticated weapon systems deployed by the adversaries, while suspicions between the U.S. on the one hand and Russia and China on the other spiral out of control.
Bahrain's top diplomat on an official visit to Israel, breaking a long-time taboo. Foreign Minister Abdel Latif al-Zayani landed in Israel on Wednesday. His controversial trip this week marks the first such visit to Israel by any official from the tiny Persian Gulf Kingdom. Al-Zayani's trip coincides with a visit to Israel by America's top diplomat Mike Pompeo. The Bahraini delegation went on to occupy Jerusalem al-Quds. The top Bahraini diplomat sat down for talks with senior Israeli officials, including his counterpart Gabi Ashkenazi and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The U.S. Secretary of State was apparently there to facilitate the controversial rapprochement. Al-Zayani's trip, which has angered the Palestinians, is part of a U.S.-backed push to normalize ties between the two sides.
It is obvious that the Trump administration wants to make sure that the normalization process and the what they used to call the deal of the century will be very crucial and strong before they get away from the power in January. So they are doing marathonian steps so that everything will be on the ground and will be very much clear laid out.
Palestinian groups denounced the trilateral meeting between the U.S., Bahrain, and Israel as a clear attack on the rights of the Palestinian people. The Palestinians want all Arab nations to refrain from establishing ties with Israel until the Israeli occupation is over and a Palestinian state becomes a reality. But as part of a U.S. brokered initiative, Bahrain and its Persian Gulf neighbor, the United Arab Emirates, signed normalization accords with Israel at the White House in mid-September. Sudan has also agreed to normalize ties with Israel as part of a deal that will guarantee much-needed U.S. financial aid. Israel has escalated its violations in the occupied territories over the past years. For instance, it has stepped up settlement construction on occupied lands. The regime has also stepped up demolition of Palestinian homes. So far this year, nearly 700 structures have been razed to the ground across the occupied West Bank, including East Jerusalem outwards. The UN says that number is more than the figure in any full year since 2016. Palestinians have widely blamed the worsening situation on policies pursued by the administration of U.S. President Donald Trump. The American president makes no secret of his extremely pro-Israel stance. Trump took the American support for the regime to a whole new level by moves such as recognizing Jerusalem al-Quds as Israel's capital. Palestinian groups now say the U.S.-backed push to normalize ties between several Arab states and Israel is further emboldening the regime. How can Palestinians now trust the U.S. as it loudly brands itself as a mediator between them and Israel? Palestinians have been fighting an uphill battle against occupation for decades. Things are perhaps tougher today as several Arab states are abandoning the cause and normalizing their ties with Israel. Palestinians say these Arab states are stabbing them in the back. Palestinians know all too well that their options are very limited at the moment. As many governments refuse to pressure the Israeli regime, the people of Palestine are hoping popular grassroots campaigns against Israel will one day change things for the better.
After months of chaos and hundreds of thousands of deaths worldwide, an end to the crisis triggered by the deadly coronavirus pandemic could be within reach. U.S. biotech firm Moderna has announced its experimental vaccine against COVID-19 was 94.5% effective. The announcement would make it the second major breakthrough in worldwide hunt for an effective vaccine. Moderna has announced that its newly developed vaccine would pose no significant side effects.
At the end of this trial, if the efficacy dropped down to 80% or even 70%, this is still really a very good result and a really strong reason to be optimistic to have a vaccine and very soon vaccine.
According to the data provided by the company, its vaccine was given in two doses 28 days apart, and the preliminary results are based on 95 volunteers of the 30,000 who fell ill with COVID-19. Just last week, U.S. drug maker giant Pfizer, along with its German partner BioNTech company, announced the invention of a separate effective vaccine against the deadly virus. According to scientific reports, a key advantage of Moderna's vaccine is that it does not need ultra-cold storage like Pfizer's, making it easier to distribute.
Oh, yes, certainly. I mean, these are really good results, although they are interim result, early stages data, but yet these are really exceeding the expectation, because what we expected in the scientific community and also the regulatory bodies were that we will have a coronavirus vaccine around 60 to 70% effective, and this vaccine, both of the vaccine, Moderna and Pfizer results are more than 90%, which
the vaccines are viewed powerful tools to fight a pandemic that has infected 54 million people worldwide and killed 1.3 million. The news also comes at a time when COVID-19 cases are soaring, hitting new records in the United States and pushing some European countries back into lockdowns. Next year, the U.S. government could have easy access to more than 1 billion doses just from the two vaccine makers, more than needed for the country's 330 million residents. Other European nations are expected to have easy access to the vaccines. Head of the World Health Organization has hailed the rapid progress towards a COVID-19 vaccine, but insisted that every country had to reap the benefits from the vaccines. Never in history has vaccine research progressed so quickly. We must apply the same urgency and innovation to ensuring that all countries benefit from this scientific achievement.
And I can announce that we have today secured an initial agreement for 5 million doses of the Moderna vaccine.
Tedros Adhanom has said other countries could not wait for bilateral agreements to get the vaccine, since the process could take years to negotiate. there are now concerns that richer countries could monopolize the distribution of the vaccine. Western nations have already ordered millions of the doses of the vaccine, potentially leaving poorer countries in Africa and Asia without supply for years to come. It's feared relatively wealthy nations will likely be able to vaccinate their entire populations.
The first agreement that we reached with the U.S. government was for an order of 100 million doses. So we anticipate to be able to ship up to 20 million of those 100 million before the end of the year. So we are making product, as you know, every day and stockpiling it. And assuming we get the green light from the FDA, I would say sometime in December, I'm sure General Perna from Operation Warp Speed will be ready with the trucks to load the product and to distribute it in the US via the CDC guidelines.
The EU has already ordered 200 million doses of Pfizer's vaccine, while the UK has ordered 40 million doses. People in low-income countries could be waiting until 2024. Drug-making companies could also benefit profusely from the world's deadliest pandemic in recent memory. Pfizer and BioNTech could make $13 billion from coronavirus vaccine.
A mega free trade pact came into existence a few days ago. The Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership has been described as the largest free trade agreement in history. 10 Southeast Asian countries, as well as China, South Korea, Japan, Australia, and New Zealand, formed a brand new trading bloc. The agreement was signed on the sidelines of the annual meeting of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations on Sunday, after nearly a decade of negotiations. What makes the RCEP very important is its sheer size, nearly a third of global economy. The world's largest trading bloc has become a reality as the international community is grappling with the devastating economic impact of the coronavirus pandemic. It is hoped that the RCEP will spur economic recovery from the downturn caused by the virus. Meanwhile, the new agreement, which excludes the United States, is widely viewed as a geopolitical victory for the world's second largest economy, China. Observers believe it will boost China's influence in the region at a time when the U.S. is taking a tough line on its arch economic rival.
I can't emphasize enough how important the free trade agreement is for the reshaping of international political and economic relationships. And this will clearly strengthen China's hand in trying to keep the United States from its somewhat hostile incursions into what the Chinese government considers its territories.
The RCEP is described by some experts as a major win for multilateralism and free trade, despite America's withdrawal from many international agreements. The new free trade agreement is often compared to the Trans-Pacific Partnership deal that U.S. President Donald Trump defiantly tore apart soon after he took office. The administration of U.S. President Donald Trump has been particularly confrontational in its economic strategy. The White House has implemented protectionist policies like no other U.S. administration. It has taken a tough line on China, blaming it for a large part of America's trade deficit. The U.S. has also engaged in trade conflicts with other major players like the European Union. But Trump's protectionist agenda is not preventing the rest of the world from pursuing free trade at different levels. The Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership is proof that the world prefers multilateralism.
That will give extraordinary support to the multilateralization of international trade in a way that perhaps is not contemplated in the concept of bipolarity or even in the notion of globalization as it was being considered in recent years.
Even America's close allies, like the EU, are engaged in free trade negotiations. Trump's protectionist agenda may eventually backfire, because as a growing number of countries sign free trade deals, American exporters may soon find themselves losing ground to international competitors. But who knows what direction America will take in the future? Trump will probably have to leave the White House in January, and that does not give him enough time to complete his America First project. The projected winner of the U.S. presidential election, Joe Biden, will face many dilemmas exactly because of Trump's controversial policies. Biden's presidency will probably mean a more traditional U.S. role on the world stage. He could bring back America from the brink of a full-blown trade and military conflict with China. But he cannot abruptly do away with Trump's protectionism to join free trade deals, because right now, many Americans would see any such decision as throwing away U.S. jobs.
In the limelight.
For years, it had been assumed that superior skills in facial recognition could be taught and would help those working in police and security agencies to make more accurate judgments about a person's identity. While this is true up to a point, research has found that the remarkable abilities demonstrated by super recognizers can't be learned. Researchers think they are coded into our DNA, and only a very small proportion of people have the genetic disposition to develop these extreme abilities. Dr. James Dunn from the University of New South Wales in Australia says, "The term super recognizers was coined by researchers in 2009 in response to some of the exceptional results people were achieving on face recognition tests. In statistical terms, super recognizer describes anyone who scores two standard deviations above the average person. In other words, a person in the top 1 or 2% of the population." Dr. James Dunn said, "What we've found is that face recognition varies naturally, like IQ does. And just like IQ, it appears that a large proportion of that variance is genetically determined." We now present you an article written by researchers at the University of New South Wales in Australia under the heading, "Super recognizers possess extraordinary ability to memorize and recall faces." The article has been taken from the scitechdaily.com website. Please stay with us for more. While in Paris, France in the 1990s, Georgie briefly watched a professional photographer taking pictures of kids playing in a small park near Les Halles and thought nothing of it. 10 years later, she was having breakfast in Australia's Byron Bay backpackers and asked the man next to her whether he was a photographer and if he had ever taken pictures of children playing in a Paris park. Amazed, he only said that he was and that he had. He even showed her his portfolio of the actual pictures she had witnessed him taking a decade earlier. Coincidences like these would probably go unnoticed by most of us, but Georgie has a special ability that only 2% of the world's population is endowed with. She is a super recognizer. Such people possess an extraordinary ability to memorize and recall faces of people they may have only encountered in the most unremarkable and sometimes fleeting situations, often many years before. In research published in PLOS-1, psychologists from the Forensic Psychology Laboratory at University of New South Wales in Sydney, Australia, argue that the freely available University of New South Wales face test, which they have been using since 2017 to identify the world's best performing super recognizers, is a perfect screening tool to sort the good, the very good, and the exceptional face recognizers from the rest of the population. The researchers, including Dr. James Dunn, Scientia Fellow Dr. David White, and Dr. Alice Towler, say the University of New South Wales face test is able to provide more precision when it comes to ranking the abilities of super recognizers, especially when used in conjunction with existing face recognition tests, like the Glasgow Face Matching Test and the Cambridge Face Memory Test. The University of New South Wales face test was deliberately designed by the researchers to be very challenging. As a result, average performers rank at the low end of the scale. Unlike other existing tests where performance of candidates is more evenly spread across the measurement scale. Out of 31,000 people who have taken the University of New South Wales face test since 2017, nobody has ever scored 100%. The highest anyone has achieved is 97%. This means the person with the best facial recognition abilities in the world could still be out there. Dr. James Dunn says when people do the University of New South Wales face test, they discover it's really difficult, with most people scoring between 50 and 60%. He says, but super recognizers are people who score 70% and higher. We made it difficult so that it's not too easy for the very best super recognizers, adding, when super recognizers do the traditional face test, they max out at 100%, which means it's difficult for us to differentiate between the very good and the exceptionally good. Dr. James Dunn notes, if anybody came to us thinking they may be a super recognizer, we would start them on the University of New South Wales face test, and then get them to do further confirmatory tests and say, you need to do well on all of them for us to be confident that you're a super recognizer. For many years, it has been assumed that superior skills in facial recognition could be taught and would help those working in police force and security agencies to make more accurate judgments about a person's identity. While this is true up to a point, new research has found that the remarkable abilities demonstrated by super recognizers can't be learnt. Researchers think they are coded into our DNA, and only a very small proportion of the population have the genetic disposition to develop these extreme abilities. Dr. James Dunn says the term super recognizers was coined by researchers in 2009 in response to some of the exceptional results people were achieving on face recognition tests. In statistical terms, super recognizer describes anyone who scores two standard deviations above the average person. In other words, a person in the top 1 or 2% of the population. Dr. James Dunn continues, what we've found is that face recognition varies naturally like IQ does, and just like IQ, it appears that a large proportion of that variance is genetically determined. The University of New South Wales researchers are interested in super recognizers for two reasons. First of all, the more scientists learn about super recognizers and how they process faces, the more they can decode what is going on in the brain when we see both familiar and unfamiliar faces. And secondly, governments and commercial organizations are increasingly searching for people with superior face recognition abilities. Dr. James Dunn adds, we are starting to see industries looking within and outside of their organizations for super recognizers to work in specialized face identification roles. He added, this can include police, but may also include government and commercial bodies like immigration, intelligence agencies, security agencies, financial institutions, and even coffee shops. According to new research, there are no other common traits shared among super recognizers besides their skill itself. Super recognizers come from all walks of life, and have the same spread of intelligence profiles as the general population. While many may not realize they are super recognizers, some had an inkling they were pretty good with faces at a young age. Nicole was just 11 years old when she realized she could recognize all her teachers' baby faces in a competition at her school. She says, "When everyone else was struggling to find just a couple of faces they knew, I correctly identified all 20 faces very easily. At the time, I thought it was strange, but it felt super cool too." Likewise, Wai Yin said she first realized she was a super recognizer when still a teenager. She added, "I used to look at magazines and circle people's faces instead of looking at the clothes. That's when I thought there's something weird going on." For Kelly, it wasn't until she sat at the University of New South Wales face test and was contacted by researchers that she even knew that she had the skill. But she adds, "I have always been a perfectionist and had an extremely abnormal eye for detail with everything. A lot of super recognizers start to wonder about their gift when watching television." Jessica says, "My husband and I were arguing over somebody on television looking like someone else," adding, "My husband said he thought he was pretty good at recognizing faces and Googled and found the University of New South Wales' online test. He completed it and achieved around 50%. She says, "I completed the test and had a much higher score and thought, I'm definitely better at recognizing faces than my husband. Automatic win on that topic. It wasn't until the University of New South Wales researchers contacted me that I realized my score was not within the normal range. I joined a lot of dots after that." Most see the skill as a gift that makes life more interesting or even helps in one's career. Duncan says being a super recognizer has helped in his line of work, which is recruitment. Duncan says, "People are always extremely flattered when you remember them, or if we haven't actually met in person and have only seen their picture on social media, they are usually pretty shocked. But others with the gift are a bit more cautious about exposing it." Marcus says, "It can make things quite awkward." Marcus added, "I'm quite social, so I tend to walk up to people and remember, and I soon realize they don't remember me." Sally resorts to hiding her skill. She says, "I often have to lie that I've never met or seen people before," adding, "It freaks them out. Oh, I saw you last week at Woolworths. Makes you sound like a stalker." Amanda reports a similar observation. She says, "On a daily basis, I have given up on saying things to people like, 'Hello, we were talking in the queue at Coles supermarket last week. Do you remember me?' I just got too many weird looks and I started to feel like I was creepy sometimes, again thinking people would recognize me like I can recognize them." In the end, David says the super recognizer trait can be a mixed blessing. David added, "Being good at recognition comes with its own problems, feeling like the world is too small sometimes, but it has its good parts too. It's allowed me in the leisure industry to build a good rapport with customers, and I can remember every single customer." Having developed the University of New South Wales face test to find super recognizers, the research team now plans to invite many of them into the laboratory to understand exactly why they are so super at face recognition.
Thought. in America. Islam is new. They don't like us. It's an indication that we really have not delved into the real history of our country. And that becomes our responsibility now. In this day and age, for this generation, with all of the resources that you have at your disposal, that your predecessors did not have, but you have now, the means to communicate across some very serious divides and make the decisions to eradicate the artificial barriers that have been erected for us and begin to carve out some new ground based on the history of Islam in America and in the African-American Muslim community and the struggles that were fought for our faith and the right to name ourselves and to have our faith front and center, to have our faith define who we are. We always sought to have people know who we were by our faith tradition. We certainly could not change the color of our skin, right? But we wanted people to know who we were as a religious community. And this goes back centuries ago. The enslaved Africans who came here, many of them came as Muslims, and they were stripped of their language and their culture, their names, their identities. And we never ask the question, we say, oh, they lost their religion. But in fact, they didn't lose their religion. So we didn't ask the question, well, what happened to those Muslims? Who are they? You know, what became of them? And what happened to them? So I will ask you to take the initiative to do the research yourself and find out who your ancestors are. And they are not just those ancestors that you might be aware of from back home, because many of them came to these shores and settled on this shore. In terms of struggle, we're all in some form of struggle, but we need to get out of the habit of apologizing for who we are and just take the plunge to stand up and be who we are, to challenge the status quo, and that we must do. Otherwise, we are simply complicit in all of the wrongdoing that comes in our name. And we have to be the ones to stand up and say, not in my name. You will not commit atrocities. You will not abuse people. You will not malign people, whether they are Muslims or not, in our names. As active, viable citizens of this land, we have a responsibility. And I say to you that you don't have to reinvent the wheel. You have a legacy of a community that has done that and continues to do that consistently. One of the things that I like to share and that really irks me to this day is we see so many images of starving children in Africa. We never broach the subject of Africa as one of the richest, if not the richest, continent on the planet. So my question is why? Why are they starving? Why are they suffering? Where are all the resources? We are people who have had our resources and our wealth usurped, taken from us, stolen from us. And you don't really realize blood, sweat, and tears that went into making, you know, the foundational pieces that went into making this country through the free labor that was contributed by enslaved Africans, many of them who were Muslim. These are histories that you need to know so that when you go out and talk about the degrees that we have, you know, and the wealth that we've accumulated over time, when you entered the class of elites, many of us, you have to know and remember and reach back that there are communities of color, specifically African-American communities, that have paved the way for your ascension into these categories and begin to push back on the obvious atrocities that you see perpetrated every day before you in the name of democracy. You know that many of our children are suffering right here at home, the prison industrial complex, from school, the pipeline to prison, right? Why are young black men and more increasingly young black women targeted and incarcerated? And we have viable research that talks to us about how our children are treated in schools, girls and boys, how they are targets, not just by their peers, but by law enforcement at a very early age. The educational system that we've always challenged as African Americans in this country, we early on understood that we had to educate our own children because we knew that they were not going to get the kind of education that they needed to survive and prosper. Well, that still remains as we enter the vaulted halls of the elite universities in this country, the Ivy League communities. We also know that those Ivy League universities are predicated on their involvement in slavery in the early days. So we should never underestimate the power of that kind of legacy, how it continues to influence and carry into the world as we become adults, accomplished professionals, and go out in the world and speak about advancement, liberation, so forth. We need to go back home and create some really serious conversations within our communities about what side of the equation are we on. You know, do we want to be a part of the solution, or are we content to be a part of the problem and reap whatever benefits are given to us as a result of our complicity? So that is not the way of viable Muslim. We are always pushing for a greater liberty for everyone, including our own, but never just our own, because when we push for the greater community, our Muslim community is part of that as well. So I say also younger people need to have a seat at the table from the beginning so that we can hear their voices and plan for their future. And I would like to request that we begin to reach out to the Native American community. We didn't just land here, you know. These people, they've been here for a while. And when we are facing climate change, these are the communities that we need to be embracing and learning from. We have a lot of work to do, but we have a lot of also unrealized allies in the world. So to get out of our silos, to be bold enough to challenge the status quo. Don't go along with what we know is unjust because it's in our own perceived interest, because ultimately it is not in your own best interest. But when we fight for total liberation for everybody. And when we do that, we see that, wow, the world is really, really a beautiful place. And we're all struggling together, and our umbrella gets wider and bigger, and then you can really enjoy the diversity of this great community that we call Islam in America. So we stand ready to stand by you and urge you on to be fierce and bold in your opposition to oppression, inshallah. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
IRIB English Radio.